Spirit Rock built its four residence halls or dormitories. They were appropriately named after the four divine abodes. So the first is Metta, or loving kindness. The second is Karuna, or compassion. The third is Mudita, sympathetic joy, or just joy, as it's often referred to. And the last is Upekkha, or equanimity. And they're always listed in that order because it's said that they build on each other. Loving kindness leads to compassion, which leads to sympathetic joy, which leads to equanimity. But like all Buddhist lists, they're not just linear. They also are intertwined. And so loving kindness leads to compassion, but compassion also leads to loving kindness. And both lead to sympathetic joy, and sympathetic joy leads to loving kindness and compassion. They're all heart-opening practices. And they're all things that we both cultivate and are a result of practice. So we cultivate loving kindness. The more we cultivate loving kindness, the more the heart opens and the more loving kindness we experience. And we cultivate compassion. And the more we do, the more the heart opens and the more compassion we feel. And the same with sympathetic joy and equanimity. So I'll take each one separately. We'll talk a little bit about. And then at the end, we'll do some metta practice, loving kindness practice. So the first is, as I said, metta, or loving kindness. Also known as freedom of the heart. And Sharon Salzberg, who is a Vipassana teacher in Massachusetts, wrote this book, Loving Kindness, a few years ago, which is a very, very good reference for not only metta, but all four of the Brahma Viharas. Metta is a concentration practice. There are retreats that are done just following metta practice, and I have had people tell me that they get extremely high just doing a weekend or 7 days or 10 days of nothing but loving kindness. You can imagine just repeating phrases over and over all day long for 7 or 10 days, the heart opening that would happen. So it's a natural kind of high. The important thing to remember about metta is that although the phrases we do refer to other people, it's really about opening our own heart. So sometimes the phrases may seem trite, or they may seem unrealistic. Sometimes I know I've found myself saying phrases and I think, you know, it's ridiculous, that's not going to happen. But I remind myself that's not the point. The point is to open my heart, not whether it's actually going to happen or not. But people report amazing things, amazing changes in people long distances away. There are stories of people doing loving kindness for someone that lives 3,000 miles away and a few days later getting a letter from them apologizing for some long-ago transgression or something that you recognize their heart has opened. So never underestimate the power of loving kindness. It can be a very, very powerful practice. There are some traditional phrases that are used in loving kindness, which I'll use later when we do the metta practice, but it's perfectly fine to substitute your own phrases. They're meant as a guide. They're meant as a beginning. But sometimes what a teacher says doesn't fit for you, doesn't fit at that time, or doesn't fit at all. So it's perfectly fine to use your own phrases. I just read one today that said, "May my heart be kind." I like that. May my heart be kind. There are many, many uses for metta or loving kindness, not just on retreat or not just during a practice period, but throughout the day. Many of us have adopted the practice of metta or loving kindness every time we hear a siren, not knowing perhaps what the siren is for, who's involved, what's happening. Often there's a feeling of helplessness. You know, we don't know what's going on, or even if we do, we don't know what we can do. We can always do metta. We can always send loving kindness to whomever is involved, whether we know who it is or not. I find it very useful reading the paper, reading of earthquakes or a large plane crash or anything like that, where I may know nobody involved, but it helps me to feel that I can have some effect, or I can do something by just repeating loving kindness phrases, by wishing all the people involved loving kindness, wishing them well, or wishing them ease, or wishing them strength for whatever it is that they need to go through. It's a great practice for traffic jams. A lot of people find that a good place to practice metta. So instead of getting ourselves all uptight and anxious and angry, which is so easy to do, sending the other person many metta or loving kindness. It's a way of meeting anger or hatred or aversion that may be directed at us. Instead of responding with the same aversion or hatred, we can respond with loving kindness instead. And it may or may not make a difference. Often it does. Often people find that the situation gets diffused, or things may stop with meeting that kind of aversion with loving kindness. It's also important to remember that loving kindness is a process, and that we don't sit down, do some practice of loving kindness, and expect that things are going to change immediately or change dramatically. That doesn't usually happen. But over time, our heart can open. Over time, things may change. As with everything, it's important to remember that it's a process, that it doesn't just happen overnight, but it builds. It's also important to remember that with loving kindness practice, the opposite feelings may arise. And this can be very disconcerting to people. They come to do a day of loving kindness or even just an evening, and they find hatred arising, really strong aversion. And sometimes people get scared, or they think they're not doing it correctly, and they may leave. But quite the opposite is the case. It means that the practice is working, that the heart is opening and what is there is being revealed. And it's only by that being revealed that it can be transformed. Jim and I were talking before we started the sit, and he was talking about how Ajahn Sumedho has said that what might be most important is sending loving kindness to the difficult places in ourselves. Not just maybe to the difficult people in our lives or difficult situations, but the difficult parts of ourselves that need loving kindness. Our own greed, hatred, delusion, whatever fear, ignorance, whatever unpleasant states we're experiencing. We can meet them with loving kindness rather than pushing them away, resisting, or fighting with them. With loving kindness, we always begin with ourselves. And we always begin by sitting in a comfortable position. It's very hard to send loving kindness, to let the heart open, if we're sitting in a very uncomfortable position, or if we're tight or tense. So it's always, whenever teachers do loving kindness practice, they will always stop and offer people the opportunity to move, to change posture, so that they're comfortable while doing it. And we begin by sending loving kindness to ourselves. Often, not always, but often we begin with a forgiveness practice. So we offer forgiveness to ourselves for whatever harm we may have done to someone else, whatever harm we may have done to ourselves. And then, likewise, offering forgiveness to someone else. If anyone else has harmed us in any way, whether they knew it or not, or meant to or not, if it feels harming to us, then we offer forgiveness to them. Then there are two ways that we can proceed. One is we go from ourselves to a benefactor, someone for whom it's easy to wish well, to wish loving kindness. From a benefactor, we go to a neutral person, someone we don't know well, we don't have any particular strong feelings for. From that, we may go to a more difficult person. And sometimes not right away. Sometimes it takes time to build up to sending well wishes to someone with whom we have a really difficult time. The other way of going is we start with ourselves again, and then we expand to the room, and then we expand to the city we're in, and then we expand to the state, and then the country, and then the world, and ultimately to all beings in all directions, all living beings. I'd like to read just a part of the Metta Sutta, which is in Sharon's book. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, or despise any being in any state. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down. Free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. And the second one is karuna, or compassion. In Buddhist lingo, we rarely hear or use the word love. Instead, often compassion is the term that's used. Sometimes loving kindness also. The Dalai Lama talks a lot about compassion. Often he talks about it in terms of kindness. Compassion can sometimes be confused. People often confuse it with pity, thinking that feeling sorry for someone is compassion. And that's not really what it's about. Pity is considered the near enemy of compassion. Pity has in it a sense of separateness, a sense of poor you. You know, you are suffering, so I don't suffer like that. So there's that sense of separation, and there can be that sense of hierarchy. You know, I'm better than you. I don't have that same kind of suffering. And that's not the idea at all. The idea is recognizing the humanness in compassion or in suffering. Recognizing that I too perhaps have been there, may be there, I understand. And there's no sense of I need to help you, or I need to fix it, or I need to take care of it. Just that I'm here for you. I understand. And I'll be available for what you need. But there's a sense of trust, a sense of understanding that you can handle whatever it is that's going on. I don't need to take over for you, but I am here as support and with an openness to do, as I say, what is required. Compassion and wisdom are considered two arms or two legs in Buddhist practice. It's said that compassion without wisdom becomes sloppy. It's codependent. Likewise, wisdom without compassion can be cold, uncaring, unsensitive, or at least seem that way. So it's important that the two go together, that there's compassion and also wisdom, so that we use our wisdom with our compassion to be with someone. And we use our compassion along with wisdom to do what needs to be done. Again, compassion is a quality that we both cultivate and that naturally arises. Compassion also naturally arises out of our mindfulness practice. So if we are mindful, if we do the practice of mindfulness, we find that compassion spontaneously arises as we see things clearly. As we see the situation clearly, there is a spontaneous compassion, a spontaneous sense of wanting to be there that naturally arises. And compassion is not limited. It's not necessarily compassion for a particular person or only a particular person. It's unbounded. We feel compassion for anyone and everyone, not just those closest to us, or those whom we love, or those that we know best, but compassion for those that we don't know. When we hear of tremendous suffering in the world, we feel compassion for those people, whether we know them or whether we don't. We also feel compassion for both the perpetrator and the victim. Often that seems strange. People don't understand. But the compassion is not limited to one or the other. It is, in fact, for both, because both are in a place of suffering. This was shown so clearly in Dead Man Walking, where Sister Prejean shows compassion for the victim, but also for the perpetrator, the killer. And this is often what Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, showing compassion for the pirate as well as the young girl that the pirate has abused. This is his poem where he speaks of, I am the pirate and I am also the young girl. Many of you may have read on the internet or seen in other places a poem that was written after September 11th, not by Thich Nhat Hanh, although it was originally attributed to him, but by a couple that modeled it after his poem, where they talk about being all of the different elements of September 11th. The firemen, the victims, the terrorists, we on the other coast who are so far away, and on and on and on. It's a way of opening our hearts to everyone. The third vihara is mudita, or sympathetic joy. And this, for many of us, is the most difficult one. It has been for me. Recently, I have noticed that it's often stated or translated as just joy rather than sympathetic joy. But there's a difference, and I'll talk about that. First, I want to read from the Dhammapada about joy. Live in joy, in love, even among those who hate. Live in joy, in health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Sympathetic joy, which is how I originally learned it, means delighting in or being happy for the happiness of other people. Delighting in someone else's success or achievement or happiness. And this is a place where often we can get stuck. It can be one thing to have compassion or be open to everyone or to people in general. It can be another thing sometimes to feel the joy for someone else. If we have any sense of insecurity or lack or not feeling joy ourselves, it can be very difficult then to feel the joy for someone else. I remember a time several years ago in a work situation where that came up for me. I don't remember exactly what the situation was, but I remember that someone was very happy about something. And I remember saying to a coworker, you know, I'm so unhappy, or whatever it was I was, I can't feel that joy. I can't feel that happiness. And I felt badly about it, of course. Fortunately, the person I said it to was very understanding and said, I know what you mean. So I didn't have to feel so bad. It was accepted. But it can be very difficult if we're not feeling joy to be happy for somebody else's happiness. It often, their happiness can reflect to us perhaps our own unhappiness, our own pain in some way. And it can be very challenging to allow ourselves to sort of set ourselves aside, set aside our own ego, and just be happy for that other person. Just be happy for their happiness, whatever it is. It can help us to recognize our interconnectedness. You know, that what is good for someone or what someone else has experienced as happiness actually brings happiness to us too. That it's good for all of us. It's not just limited. Sharon says, "It's a rare and beautiful quality to feel truly happy when others are happy." She also talks about six or seven hindrances that sympathetic joy, cultivating sympathetic joy, can help free us from. And the first is judging. Many of us have unrelenting judging minds. And delighting in someone else's happiness can help free us from that judge, because there's no judging in sympathetic joy. We're just delighting in their happiness without any judging. It can help free us from the idea that we know what's right or we know what's best, and just accept someone else's pleasure. It can free us from comparing. In Buddhist terms, comparing is known as conceit. Generally, we tend to think of conceit as feeling better than someone. But in Buddhist terms, conceit is any kind of comparing, whether we feel better, less than, or the same. It's still comparing. And there's great pain, great suffering in comparing. It creates a very turbulent, very restless mind. And so cultivating sympathetic joy can help relieve us of that comparing. Also, prejudice, because it is non-discriminating. It's not sympathetic joy for certain people, certain class of people, or certain kind of people, or certain things, but joy for anyone's pleasure, anyone's happiness. It can free us from a demeaning attitude. And that means, demeaning is when we make someone else's success or happiness less in some way so that we feel better. Oh, well, she really is lucky, or he really had it easy from the beginning, or, some kind of explanation that somehow takes away from the value or the importance of what that person has done. Generally, as I say, we do that so that we feel better. We may be feeling a lack or feeling less than because someone else has succeeded and perhaps we haven't. Practicing joy for others then can free us of that demeaning attitude. Demeaning can imply a limit, that there's almost only so much success or only so much happiness to go around. And if somebody else has a big chunk of it, then there won't be enough for me. And of course, the truth is it's boundless, it's endless. Envy, it can also free us from envy, which probably all of you know is really a killer. From avarice, which is defined as selfishness. And Sharon says from boredom. I'm not sure I totally understand that. I'm not sure what I would say about boredom, but she says that that's one of the qualities it can free us from. The allies of sympathetic joy are often the other Brahma Viharas: compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. Also, generosity. Generosity is a foundational practice. That is, it can be done prior to any other practice. And it also is a part of about all other practices. So interwoven in the four Brahma Viharas, even though generosity isn't one of them, it is an intermingled practice. And sharing merit is an ally to sympathetic joy. Often, after an evening of practice or a day of practice, a time of practice, we offer the merit gained from such practice to all beings everywhere. Our practice is never just for ourselves, but for all beings. The last one is upekkha, or equanimity. This is my favorite. I'm always very happy when I go to Spirit Rock and they put me in the last building, upekkha. I like to dwell in equanimity. Equanimity can be spoken of in several different ways. Sometimes it's said that it's meeting all things equally. Sometimes it's considered walking in balance. Sometimes it's considered an intimacy with all things. It is a state of calm, of peace, of silence, of stillness. And it can be confused with indifference. That's the near enemy of equanimity. It is not indifference. Indifference often means a shutting off, a turning away. There's generally some aversion with indifference, and this is not equanimity. Indifference can be very cold, very unfeeling and caring. Equanimity, on the other hand, although it's not great passion, is actually a very joyful state because it is very peaceful and very calm. And it is a way of meeting things in probably the most effective way. When we come out of equanimity, we are most likely to respond in the most helpful way. And we are most likely to respond, not to react. Often, we're used to reacting. We're used to a lot of emotionalism. And sometimes emotionalism gets confused with really deep caring. You know, some people believe that the more emotional I am, the more I must care. The more despairing I am, the more I really care. And often that's just not true. What that usually means is that we're caught somehow. Our buttons are getting pushed. We're stuck. And out of it comes this highly emotional response. With equanimity, we're not caught. We're right there, present, but not caught. So we can be available to respond in the most appropriate way. We can really be there and not caught in our own kind of stuff. My favorite equanimity story, which I've heard many different ways and probably at least some of you have heard, I recently just read it. I always thought it was a Buddhist story, but I recently read that it was from a Chinese story. But whatever it's from, it points to this quality of equanimity. And it's something like a farmer is given a brand new stallion horse. And it's a beautiful horse. And all of his neighbors say, "Oh, how wonderful. You are so lucky. That is such a beautiful horse." And the farmer says, "Maybe so. Don't know." So he lets his son learn to ride the horse. And after riding for some time, the son falls off the horse and breaks his leg. And the friends and neighbors say, oh, that's too bad. Oh, you poor son. That's terrible that he has a broken leg." And the farmer says, "Maybe so. Don't know." Well, then time goes on. A year later, war breaks out in the land. And all the young men are conscripted are called to come and go to battle. But the farmer's son can't go because he has this broken leg. And so then all the neighbors say, oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful that your son has a broken leg and so he doesn't have to go to war. And so you get the point. We never know. What looks like a tragedy can turn out to be a blessing. What looks like a blessing can turn out to be a tragedy. So it's that equanimity, is that meeting things without that judgment, without that sense of either tragedy or blessing, but just, this is what is. This is what is. This is what is. It's the wisdom of seeing things as they are, of seeing clearly. It's a wise acceptance of things, not trying to change them, not trying to control them, but just allowing things to be as they are. That often is misunderstood in our culture because we're not taught that things are okay just as they are, or that we should accept things just as they are. We're taught that we should change things. We should be in control, and that we should change things. And so equanimity is often misunderstood. Because sometimes we have the greatest effect when we don't try to change them, when we're not trying to control things. And it doesn't mean non-action. It doesn't mean not doing anything. We may, in fact, take great action. We may do a lot. But when it's done with equanimity, it's very different than when it's done with the force of needing to control or needing to change or needing to have things be a different way. Equanimity can strengthen other states of mind, other qualities of mind, such as honesty, or strength, or trust, or flexibility. It encourages flexibility and a non-rigidity. Equanimity is like taking the one seat. It's like in the Native American tradition, the vision quest, where one finds a place, sits, and allows whatever to come and to go. Or it's like Rumi's poem about the guest house, where again he allows whatever guests to come and welcomes them all and allows them to depart. It's like the earth. The earth accepts all things. It accepts whatever we give it. Spittle, piss, whatever. The earth doesn't react. It takes it all. Or like the sun. The sun shines on everything equally. It doesn't choose to shine on certain things more than others. The sun is the sun, and it radiates. It shines. There's a saying that I like that goes with equanimity. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and sorrow, come and go like the wind. To be happy, rest like a great tree in the midst of them all. So I think what we'll do, I'd like to do about 15 minutes of metta practice. We'll do that, and then if we have a few minutes at the end for comments or questions, we can do that. So take a comfortable posture. Allow your eyes to close gently if that's comfortable. Take a couple of deep breaths, just to relax and get yourself here. And then allow your attention to come to your heart, allowing whatever is there to be there. No judging, no turning away, accepting whatever is there. And if it's available, allow your heart to open. If it's not, don't worry about it. But if you can relax, allow the heart to open. And then we begin with ourselves. I will repeat three or four pretty traditional phrases. You can repeat them silently to yourself, or if they don't fit for you, use your own phrases. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I live with ease. May I be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And now bring to your mind what we call a benefactor. That is, someone who has befriended you in some way, has been a mentor, someone that you appreciate, but you don't have a real strong or deep connection with. So there's no messiness. And in the same way that we wished for ourselves, we wish for this person. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And now bring to your mind a neutral person. That is, someone that you know or are acquainted with, but you don't know well. And you don't have feelings one way or the other, positive or negative. Someone, you know, like the mail carrier or the grocery store clerk or... And again, as we wish for ourselves, we wish for this person. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And now bring to mind anyone you know who may be having difficulty right now. Difficulty in any way. Serious illness, financial difficulties, emotional difficulties. And we wish that person or those persons well. May you be happy. May you be at peace. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And now, if you're willing, you don't have to, but if you're willing, bring to mind a difficult person. Someone with whom you have a very difficult relationship. Someone for whom it seems maybe impossible or nearly impossible to wish well. And if you don't want to, it's not possible, don't. Just bring someone else to mind. It's fine. But if you want to work with it, let that person come to mind. And again, as we wish for ourselves, we wish for this very difficult person. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And then expanding our loving kindness outward, radiating out from this room. We wish for each other and for everyone in this area, we'll say in the Bay Area. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And again, extending farther out to all people in this state. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And extending our loving kindness now to everyone in this country. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you live with ease. May you be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. And extending our circle of loving kindness now throughout the world so that it touches every living being. The birds of the air, the four-leggeds of the earth, the fish of the sea, as well as all humans in all directions. May all beings everywhere be happy. May all beings everywhere be at peace. May all beings everywhere live with ease. May all beings everywhere be healthy in body, mind, and spirit. So we're just at 9 o'clock. I think we'll formally end, but if anybody has questions or comments, I'll be here for a bit. Please feel free to come up and talk. And thank you.